everybody. Welcome to Feminist Buzzkills, the show that has yet to start its heated debate on who has the better version of Jolene. I'm Liz Winstead, and I'm joined by my co-host, Moji Alabodale. Hi, Moj.
Hello. I really can't wait to get started on that debate that I'm not ready for. But coming up on the show, Florida gonna Florida. This week, the Florida Supreme Court handed us a big loss and the chance at a win, all coded in DeSantis's primordial ooze.
Ooh.
Ew. Plus, Lizelle Gonzalez, a woman in Texas who was suffering from a complication from a self-managed abortion many years ago. There's an update on her case and we'll bring you up to speed.
I'm excited because it has some good news, possibly. And of course, we got guests. Asha Daya, producer and director of Someone You Know, an incredible documentary film about later abortion care, and lawyer, comedian, and Charlie Kirk Slayer, Elizabeth Booker Houston is here.
Is it Houston or Houston? I live in New York.
I think it's Houston.
I'm sure it's Houston. I'm joking. I'm just
ridiculous. I mean, I know. It's like New Yorkers are kind of assholes about how that word and how it is pronounced, which is hilarious. But we have a big show. We have lots to talk about. But you know what we really love? We love kicking off our show with a Patreon birthday shout out. Moji, whose birthday is it this month? Who are we celebrating?
Ooh, this month we are celebrating Dr. Sophia Yin, amazing doctor, also former podcast and amazing woman. Have a happy birthday, Dr. Yin.
Happy birthday, Dr. Yin. You know, we love you. And thank you so much for your support always at AAF and for the podcast on Patreon.
Liz, I'm ready to start this confession.
I think we're going to hemorrhage listeners.
Listeners, I want to preface this by saying we are working on remediation. But it turns out that the two hosts of the Feminist Buzzkill podcast have not listened to Cowboy Carter yet.
In its entirety. We've heard things.
I've heard like a song or two.
I've heard a couple of songs.
I can't wait. And that sounds like a crazy thing to say for a person who has streaming services.
You know, you have children. We were at the Supreme Court. You know, there's some, I mean, I've listened to, you know, the don't one.
Oh, absolutely. That's all.
And, you know, the Blackbird version of the Beatles.
Haven't heard that yet.
Have you seen the raging debates?
Nope.
On the internet about like
Jolene?
Well, yes. And it's Dolly and it's Miley and it's Beyonce and people are doing polls and they're having wild voting about it. And I have to say that in the polling I've seen on particularly Jolene, Dolly is remaining the winner.
I am not weighing in yet, having not heard Beyonce's version, or if I'm honest, maybe not Miley Cyrus's either. I don't know if I've ever heard that.
They're all three great, but I think with that particular song, like I remember when I heard that song growing up, it felt like Dolly Parton had a gun in her purse and she was going to take out Jolene. Like this felt like some real shit. Hey, producer friends, Angela and Remy, has anybody heard the record? Do you have thoughts? Is there thoughts?
Thoughts, please.
Hey, it's Angela. And I did listen to Jolene and it's pretty, but it wasn't inspiring. I got to say, Miley Cyrus kills it. I mean, obviously, Dolly Parton kills it. I liked it. I'm not going to say I didn't like it, but it wasn't the same kind of powerful. I did. It was beautiful. It's a pretty version of Jolene, like you said.
You know, that's a good take. It is. It's lovely.
Mm.
And but Dolly just really feels like I would not want to be Jolene if I was Dolly. If I was Jolene in Dolly's version, I wouldn't want to be Jolene. And in Beyonce's version, you're like, you feel for Beyonce, like, oh, I feel so bad for you. And with Dolly's version, you're like, let's all get together with Dolly and go fucking beat the shit out of Jolene.
For sure.
I cannot wait. Angela, have you heard any more of the album, Cowboy Carter?
Okay, now you're putting me on the spot.
Got it. Fair.
Great. I like the idea of the message behind it, because that's just me. It's not a country album. It's a Beyonce album where she's trying to get to the roots of country and the Black influence and the African-American influence of all of these different types of music.
I also am liking that discourse about Black country artists. I think I am seeing that and that's coming up. And I do, from what I understand, she elevated a lot of Black country artists that are existing now and trying to have careers. And I think that's really impressive. And what a great way to use your platform. I like that.
I know. And there's so many. I think people don't understand that there's so many Black country artists.
Exactly.
What I liked about Blackbird as well is that she elevates these artists. And in every conversation about Blackbird, she is elevating these little known African-American women country artists mm-hmm. that are getting a platform. And that is another thing that I really like, because it's Beyonce, everybody's hearing these names.
Yeah, I was reading about a woman in the Times today, a Black woman who was a banjo player, who I think is featured in some songs. And she was talking about, she was like, oh, I've been that girl that, I actually need to look up her name, but I've been that girl that talks about banjo and slavery for years. And now finally I have a bigger platform to talk about it. So that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. And like Valerie June is just so great. You know, there's like, you know, all these really great people who are out in the world have been doing it forever. In Minnesota, there's an incredible country blues artist named Mary Cutrafello, who was part of Do Re Mi Too. Mm-hmm. She did an Elvis song and it was so good. And she's just like, it, you know, she's just great. So yeah, good for Beyonce.
I like how Remy had said, I am not listening to this call. I'm not.
I mean, there's a lot happening. So I'm glad for Beyonce's. I also like to see like all these Black country artists weighing in and their TikToks of gone up and yeah. people I've never known before, or that, because I also think too, there's this like crossover world where there's a lot of these artists who are in these other spaces, like, you know, Americana music that doesn't get played, like the Jayhawks and Wilco and, you know, Roseanne Cash, who aren't really country and they're kind of roots. And I think that I just like that Beyonce busted all the country charts with her not country record,
yes.
with a Beyonce record, you know, just straight up saying, just because you put a cowboy hat on doesn't mean you're a cowboy. You know, why do the roots of our country involve outfits? It's very weird.
Well, we all know all culture worth knowing in America, except for Dutch Pennsylvania culture is very much Black culture. It's just been repackaged and reappropriated. So it's also nice to, I feel like growing up, a lot of people were like, oh, I listen to everything but country music. And that's probably not true any longer for everyone who said that to me when they were 14.
So we'll listen to it. Don't hate us for not listening to it.
Pity us.
That we haven't had the time to absorb it.
That is the correct stance for us to take. Pity us. Yeah, that's good. All right, Liz, let's really cook up the show with a big old steaming dump of this week's abortion news.
Okay, kick it off, Mojay.
All right. A new study finds more and more folks are turning to Twitter for advice on contraception, but shockingly, it doesn't look like they're getting answers from informed authorities. Only about 6% of tweets on reversible birth control methods come from official news or healthcare sources. And fewer than 1 in 10 posts come from an expert source on contraception. The rest were just replies from Alex Jones with the word whore written in all caps.
And in This Is My Shocked Face news, turns out one of the plaintiffs in the Doctors with Borders suit, aka the abortion pill case before the Supreme Court, is a bigger shit statue than all the rest of the doctors involved in the case. Dr. Tyler Johnson used his position as a state senator to try to get a malpractice suit against him sealed. The lawsuit involved a patient who arrived in the emergency room in respiratory distress and showing signs of sepsis from recently giving birth. According to court filings, Johnson provided substandard care, discharged her prematurely, and she died within 20 minutes of leaving his care. So I guess this dysfunctional Johnson feels entitled to opt out of not only treating patients who need abortion care, but who need postnatal care, or really any medical care that may inconvenience him during his shift at the ER.
And finally, everything in Texas is bigger, even the incels. The Texas Idiocracy Playbook is working, as a new study shows 80% of Texans don't know the extent of their state's abortion ban. Okay, great. By eliminating actual sex ed and creating bounty hunting laws to scare people out of even having conversations about abortion access, it's harder for Texas women to get good info than it is for the unfuckables who created these laws to find the G-spot. And that was this week's steaming news dump.
Woof. And that is this week's steaming news dump. Wow.
Liz, let's get to talking about the stories we want to break down further.
Well, in a decision we've been waiting for months, the Florida Supreme Court finally ruled on two cases. One, whether a 15-week ban that was passed in 2022 violated their state constitution, which they ruled it did not. And the other is whether a citizen ballot of initiative to codify abortion into their constitution could move forward in the November elections, which it can. Wow. It's a lot to unpack. It's sort of good and maybe good news, which is, you know, always in Florida. So suspect. So let's start with the abortion ban first. So in 2022, right before the Dobbs leak and Dobbs happened, Florida passed a 15-week abortion ban. It went to the Supreme Court. And the thing that's super weird is it was challenged. And while it was like petitioned the court, the legislature also passed a 6-week abortion ban, which seems like, what are they doing? And the governor signed both bills. And so what happened was, because they were challenging the 15-week ban on whether or not it violated their state constitutions, you know, right to privacy and right to access healthcare, what this meant was, if they ruled that, which they did, that the 15-week ban did not violate Florida's constitution, 30 days from when it was ruled on, which was Monday, the 6-week ban also goes into effect. Because if it can be a 15-week ban, it can also be a 6-week ban, because Roe is gone.
Right.
So what that means for Florida and the region is kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, it means that in basically in at this point, 25 days or a little bit more than 25 days, they're going to have a 6-week ban, which is not helpful for most people, because most people don't know they're pregnant around 6 weeks, or a lot of people don't.
And regionally, this is the part that's really scary. So, you know, Florida's pretty narrow across, but, you know, that long ass penis, it's a long drive from the Keys, you know, to where you would try to find abortion. And as we know, from Texas now to Florida, and from Florida to the closest safe haven is North Carolina with a 12-week ban, but a 72-hour waiting period. These folks are literally in the South right now. Right. The Southeast is in no abortions at all in Texas, in Louisiana, in Mississippi, 6-week ban in Georgia, now Florida in 25 days, and South Carolina. And it has people scrambling. So the closest places they'll be able to get to is Virginia, Illinois. And I think that is actually the closest, Virginia and Illinois. So
terrifying.
And when we think about how many millions of people that are of reproductive age that will be seeking care, Texas alone has 27 million women, you know, because people who don't identify as women are never included in any of these counts.
No one ever thinks about them.
But yeah, so if Texas alone has 27 million, you know, you start adding Florida and Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama.
Basically, abortion care is decimated in the Southeast right now and will be for a little while. But there is a little bit of bright side in the Supreme Court's rulings. Do we want to get to that yet?
When this goes into effect in 25 days, you are going to see a massive chilling effect around how people are going to access care. And we will be, you know, the month after that or so, 2 months after that, we will be getting the ruling on medication abortion and whether or not the Supreme Court will allow it to be widely accessible or reduce the access to that to something draconian as well.
7 weeks is the draconian that they would go to, right?
Nationwide, 7 weeks. So there's a lot to be looking to. And so I'm glad that we have this podcast for you, because we're going to be following the stories of how these people are going to be accessing care. Now, you just said the other piece of what the Supreme Court ruled on is whether or not Florida can have a ballot initiative.
And that's actually pretty exciting, because again, we were unsure, right? And if they hadn't allowed the ballot initiative, it'd be a 6-week ban and no hope. Right now we have a 6-week ban and a little bit of hope. And it basically, the Florida Supreme Court had to approve that a ballot measure could even move forward. And so they did say that we could go forward and have one in November. And that means that there might be one. And that ballot initiative is pretty exciting. So this ballot initiative would add into the Constitution that there is a right to an abortion for the citizens of Florida. It'll add to the Constitution that no law shall prohibit, penalize, delay, or restrict abortion before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health as determined by the patient's healthcare provider, which is mostly what we want, right? We want to put abortion care into the hands of the patient and the patient's healthcare providers. Now, we have our questions about viability and what it is and how it's kind of a useless standard. but it's much better than where Florida is right now and will be in 25 days. What it would not do is change the state legislature's authority to enact laws around minors' access to abortion, whether their parents are required to be informed, and it will maintain their judicial waiver, which we know in Florida is used weirdly and has not really been great for everyone.
Well, I mean, the thing is, judicial bypasses, they're just stigmatizing. Yeah. For somebody who needs care, if you don't know what it is, it's if you are a minor seeking abortion in many states, if you don't want to get your parents' permission, there is a pipeline that you go through where you ask the judge for permission to grant you an abortion. And it's been mostly they always get their abortions, but just you shouldn't have to do it, A. But B, in Florida, there's been hideous cases. There was a judge that literally made one of the patients show her grades and said she wasn't smart enough to get her abortion. And that person, I do believe, was somebody who DeSantis wanted to put on the Supreme Court of Florida.
Because the Floridians voted him out after that ruling.
Yes.
And then DeSantis was like, well, you would be a great Supreme Court.
And so, you know, it's that kind of shit where you're just like, oh, my God, what is happening to put a young person, you know, through having to tell a judge that you are pregnant and also to have anybody judge a teen, especially, you know, decisions for why they want to have an abortion. Teens know. They know.
Yeah, it's really, you know, we could talk about judicial bypasses for a while, but really what we want to talk about is how tough it is to get an initiative on the ballot in Florida, because it's really, really difficult.
You know, you have to get 900,000 signatures. In many states that you've seen, 200,000 here, maybe 500,000. You have to get 900,000 signatures on the ballot. And also in Florida, the Supreme Court has the right to say whether or not your ballot initiative is valid. And in many states, that's not the case. It's about negotiating the language with the attorney general normally or the secretary of state. But here there's that. And this is the big hurdle. Florida has a 60% threshold to have a ballot initiative passed. So it's not just a majority vote in November. They have to get 60% of the vote to actually pass the initiative. So,
and to really understand how unhelpful and how like hard it is to get to 60% of the vote, the Ohio ballot initiative passed with like 57%, and that was considered a success. I think usually for the ballot initiatives, I don't think any has hit 60% yet.
I think you're right. And it makes it really hard. Now the thing is, Ohio was an off-year election, and it was an off-year election, and also weeds on the ballot. So that's always helpful. You have weed and abortion. You know, Florida's got that. Ohio had that, you know, all the sexy initiatives.
All the sexy, yes.
That might be helpful just because voter turnout is better in a presidential election. So we'll see what happens. Also, the other thing that's kind of interesting is there was three judges that voted against allowing the ballot initiative to go forward. And two of them are also on the ballot in November. So we'll see how that also plays out as well. If the abortion amendment is popular, I wonder if people will make the connection about the judges who voted against it. So we'll just see how all that plays out when that happens. And also, I just think that it's important to talk just a little bit about ballot initiatives in the larger context, because while this happened, Maine and Louisiana this week also said no mas, because both Maine and Louisiana are states that don't allow citizen ballot initiatives. They have to be introduced by the legislatures, and then if the legislature say, yes, you can put it on the ballot, then the citizens are able to vote. So citizens can't generate that. And so Maine, they didn't get 2/3 of the legislature's vote to actually make that happen this week. And in Louisiana, they just shut shit down in a way that was super scary.
It's Louisiana. You know, Louisiana, even the Democrats are anti-abortion.
Yeah, exactly. And so basically, it was so shut down. And then other bills that would add exceptions like rape and incest to their near total abortion ban are also predicted to be just shut down also, because they are just horrible there. And Louisiana was the state that we were all just like jaw-droppingly sickened to read that in lieu of being able to provide abortions, they were doing C-sections on people to terminate their pregnancies.
Yeah. And I had a C-section, and it is a major abdominal surgery. And to do all that with not even the hope of a child is cruelty. It's torture.
It is torture. And I feel like, too, as we look at these ballot initiatives, there's just so much happening. Missouri's also got one coming up. And the anti-abortion people are smart, because they're now trying to do what Ohio did and failed, which is have a vote before the ballot initiative to change the way people vote. So Missouri, they're on their way to getting the votes they need. There was two ballot initiatives, one proposed by a Republican that had like a 12-week ban. It was bullshit. And then Planned Parenthood, some other good folks, created one that was decent. A lot of fighting with the attorney general. But in the same time, the right wing is like, we want to put a ballot initiative in August that says we're going to up our threshold to either 55% or 60. And you have to win 5 out of the 8 congressional districts in order for it to pass. So they're trying to put a thing up like they did in Ohio, shenanigans in August, to make it harder for the initiative that will be on the ballot in November to win. So it's like if they can't stop the ballot initiative, they're going to try to destroy any real hope for a ballot initiative to pass. So look for that.
And I also want to say, like, you know, we know that these gerrymandered districts are minority rule. And then these changes to the ballot initiatives also really do institute minority rule, right? 50% or higher is half the voters. And when you go to 60%, you're saying 40% of people can just say, we don't like this, and win.
It is really profoundly scary. And so, I mean, ballot initiatives are great, but a lot of them are still in this kind of Roe framework. And since Roe fell, it should be an opportunity for all of us to say, Roe was wrongly decided and was so vulnerable that it got us here when it fell, right? And so we need to be enshrining abortion in our federal constitution. Because these state ballot initiatives, while they're a good stopgap, until we actually say we have the constitutional right to abortion that legislators can't change and that the Supreme Court can't interpret any other way, we are going to find ourselves in this constant state of clawing and desperately wondering if we're going to die someday because somebody will deny us healthcare.
And this state to state to state just has us continually playing this game of like abortion rights, human rights, whack-a-mole, just trying to claw out some sort of humanity for each of us. And we all deserve the healthcare, the abortions that we need without having to fight this desperately or hear these desperate stories of people literally dying in parking lots.
All healthcare, but especially healthcare that has this timely, long-term implication. And we don't deserve to have it be in the hands of these people that keep getting elected in whacked out gerrymandered districts and nightmare scenarios where, like, again, we don't live in Mississippi, but it was Mississippi that ended Roe. We, you know, and sorry, I don't want that for anyone.
And also just going back to us listening to the Comstock arguments last week, why are justices deciding healthcare?
Why are justices deciding healthcare? And the hubris that you would just allow debunked statistics be in your Supreme Court case, literally 3 different studies that were thrown out for inaccuracy. And to think that you as a judge know more than expert scientists at the FDA, that is some shit that, like, that's never happened.
And to think that legislators, right, who are optometrists or HVAC owners or whatever else they were doing before they became legislators have a better sense of what individuals need in terms of healthcare than doctors, so much so that they're willing to criminalize doctors, is just a terrifying state of this country.
Terrifying. And so, you know, we just need to do better. And it seems like constantly when we talk about our stories, Moji, they derive from states over and over and over again that exist in this Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals just co-signs to every single piece of garbage in humanity. And again, your state just going back to Texas.
It all starts in Texas, Liz.
I think it all starts in the Fifth Circuit.
In Texas. I'm going to take us back to Texas. So people may remember this, but in 2022, a Texas woman was jailed for 3 days over an alleged self-managed abortion. And she is suing the state of Texas, particularly the prosecutor that prosecuted her, for his fuckery. And I am here for it. I know you remember this. Listeners, 2022, Texas was the wild, wild west, right? We had SB 8, which was the bounty hunter law that said any motherfucker who cares can sue anyone they want to who they think aided and abetted abortion. Mississippi had brought their Dobbs case all the way to the Supreme Court and they'd heard the arguments, but we hadn't had any kind of ruling. Abortion was banned at 6 weeks, basically, in Texas, even though Roe was the law of the land, because Roe is not actually helpful and fully workable for everyone. And all of a sudden, one weekend, we're like, wait a minute, this woman has been arrested for a self-managed abortion in Texas. And the abortion funds in Texas were like in full alert. Do you remember this, Liz?
I remember this so much because they used her name. The Texas state law says you cannot arrest someone for having an abortion. And that's important to know because those bounty hunting laws were going after people who were helping people get an abortion. But Texas state law says you can't arrest somebody for having an abortion. And so it was so egregious that a hospital worker turned her in and that they held her for like a couple days with like a $500,000 bail or something.
So Liz, right. Like you said, Texas has a law. You can't prosecute a pregnant person for their abortion or whatever their pregnancy outcome is. But when she showed up at the hospital, 19 weeks pregnant with no fetal heartbeat, not only was she forced to have a C-section, which horrifies me, but the hospital staff reached out to the local prosecutor, Gocha Ramirez, who had the case taken before a grand jury. And that resulted in Ms. Gonzalez's arrest, 3 days in jail, and that $500,000 fine we spoke of before.
Here's what makes me sick, is that they could have induced this pregnancy.
Yep.
And instead gave her a C-section.
Yep.
That's so unbelievable.
And increasingly common.
And also, according to Lizelle's complaint, Ramirez did none of his own investigation into the case before he went to the grand jury. He just misrepresented the facts of her case. And also, it's like annoying, but he's a Democratic prosecutor, which somehow just cuts deeper because they're supposed to care. But a Texas Democrat is like a, I don't even know what. It's really, really horrifying. Can you imagine being in the hospital and then being arrested in the hospital after your C-section and being thrown in jail? No,
not at all. So anyway, the funds rallied behind her, garnered national attention. And when the case was finally dropped, Ramirez, the prosecutor, said, oh, the issues surrounding this case were clearly contentious. However, based on Texas law and the facts presented, it's clearly not a criminal matter. Why the fuck did he arrest her?
And that's what's so gross. You know, oopsieing around people who have no agency is like, that's just so gross. And it was kind of like in the story that we did at the top of the news, the story about the mifepristone doctor who had tried to get his case sealed for mistreating a patient. It was kind of the same thing. We're going to put the, you know, we put all of our articles in the show notes, but read the article for that story too. Cause he was like, you know what? Malpractice happens. You know, it's what it's part of the deal, getting healthcare, like whatever. And it's like that they can be so cavalier and think that people don't have agency is so gross. I just feel really glad that Lizelle is fighting back.
I am also. I'm really excited that she's fighting back. Also, when I was researching the story, when I was doing my reading, I couldn't find any other case of a person who had been prosecuted in this way because of their pregnancy or their pregnancy outcome who had gone for any sort of suing or any sort of restitution. Now, she did not include the hospital in her lawsuit, but she's doing something. And that's exciting to me.
I'm glad she's suing, but how does a person like Gonzalez, what he did is really egregious. And it's like, did anything happen to that guy? Hardly anything.
Hardly anything.
The Texas State Bar investigated him and he had a $1,250 fine and a 12-month legal license probation because of how it was handled. That's it.
And it's just a probation that he can still do cases. He's still the prosecutor in that region of Texas. That was essentially a slap on the wrist. $1,200 is nothing to a lawyer.
Yeah. So I'm really glad that she's doing this. You know, this is something that we're going to talk more about because we've seen cases, Brittany Watts, who was, you know, prosecuted and released, but why people have to go through it. And why the first reaction is to arrest somebody who's gone through a traumatic pregnancy outcome. And your first response is that, like, we as a country have to ask ourselves, why are we this way?
We know the why, Liz. It's shame. It's stigma.
Yep.
That's what it is, right? Nobody wants to say, oh, this happened to me and I need to put my name in the press and my name back in the law and basically be re-victimized for any sort of restitution, but it's the shame and the stigma that allows this kind of shit to happen. And it happens. Pregnancy criminalization is an epidemic in this country, and it's only going to get worse.
That's right. And also being pregnant in the criminal justice system is also something that we are going to be covering in a podcast in the very near future. So we wanted to stay on top of that because the stories of those who are the most marginalized by these bans are the stories that we should be telling over and over and over again, because not everybody is a wealthy person that gets to get a lawyer and gets to get a publicist to tell their story. It's the people who are forgotten that are victims of these bans. and what happens to them, we really need to tell the complete story. So that is that. As always, these stories will be in our show notes. And if you are somebody who needs to access abortion, you can find the best, most up-to-the-minute resources on getting that care and funding for that care at our website, aafront.org. Our Charlie chatbot is at the bottom right of the screen and will walk anyone, anywhere in the country through all of their options and resources for abortion.
Such great stories this week, Liz.
I know they were. And we get to come to our first guest.
Yep. We're going to continue with our next great guest. Take it away.
Thank you. Our first guest on the show is a feminist journalist and storyteller who is the director and producer of the new film, Someone You Know. This documentary short brings to light three different patients and their later abortion stories, and it is incredible. Please welcome Asha Daya.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Moji. Hello, Liz. It's so wonderful to be with you on the podcast.
I cannot believe you're finally here and we're finally together.
Hi.
I feel really excited just because our paths have crossed for so long.
Yeah.
And just we've been just paralleling so profoundly that to have you here and with such a special piece of work is really awesome. So Moji and I were both like, oh my God, a documentary about later abortion is exactly what we need right now in this moment, because the anti-abortion movement just creates this one big abortion narrative that lumps all abortion experiences into this one giant narrative. And then they try to shame people for these narratives, right? You know, there's a million abortion stories to tell. And so I guess my first question is pretty much, what were things that you were hearing or not hearing about abortion or later abortion that led you to focus on people who have these particular kinds of abortions?
Yeah, well, later abortion specifically is, I feel, and what I've heard, it's talked about in such a narrow, harmful way. You know, there's the typical trope of, you know, that these pregnant people are callous, they're uncaring, these decisions are just made on a whim, and just the complete opposite of what is the reality of it. And I, as someone who has been pro-choice, not my whole life, but since I've been pro-choice, it's something that I personally never really researched enough about. I didn't do my own due diligence. And so when I was initially brought onto this project, before it became my project, it was an opportunity for me to learn more and also find out how can I show the reality of these situations and the nuance to other pro-choice people, because that is the target audience. You know, we are the majority. And what's really frustrating is that a lot of the things that I said out there about later abortions are often repeated by well-meaning pro-choice people. And so that's something that I also wanted to address, dismantle, and just bring the nuance back into the conversation, because it's so easy to hear these clickbait, ridiculous headlines and slogans and social media posts. And it's like, that is not the case. And so when we have pro-choice people who are educated enough or informed and have enough of a grasp about what later abortion entails, who this impacts the most, and why it is something that is so necessary, then hopefully we can shift the landscape and the overall conversation about all abortion access, but also specifically for this film with later abortion access. So that's my goal, and that's kind of how I wanted to focus on later abortion.
I love that you define the target and really we're like, no, this isn't for people who don't believe abortion is a good thing.
No.
And we hear this even in our politicians, right? Currently, politicians that we should trust are using phrases like restore Roe as a rallying cry to kind of prove to us that like, we're pro-abortion, we're fighting for your right. But we all know that Roe only protected abortion up to 24 weeks. And some people need abortions much later than that. So can you talk about that need and just what your documentary does to address that blind spot and the stigma that that sort of blind spot is allowed to prop up?
Yeah, you used a great word there, stigma. And that's what it really is about. Because when you hear people like Joe Biden saying, well, I'm not into
not to name names, but we name that name all the time.
Names, but we name the names. And so when Joe Biden says things like, I'm not into the whole my body, my choice, but let's restore Roe, those are two both very problematic things. And so the stigma is something that we need to address. And so when we hear politicians who don't even know how to, they're too scared of using the word abortion. It's like, well, who you're advocating for? You're you're kind of making this deferential reference to a procedure that is so necessary for so many people. And so even though Roe protected abortion access up until a certain point, which is also problematic, the whole viability, gestational, you know, limits that we've got on it. My film, the stories in my film took place before the Dobbs decision, which shows audiences that access to later abortion was already extremely problematic, extremely hard to access when you start to learn about the barriers. So that was the first thing I wanted to showcase.
That's such a good point. Before the Dobbs decision, when Roe was in place, Colorado, Maryland, Washington, D.C., and New Mexico were the only places that someone could go for a procedure if they needed later care. And there's about six doctors who actually perform them. So the critical nature of that is important. So I just wanted to name an actual like number there.
Yeah, I think that's really important because it's only going to get much, much worse. And so when you look at the main reasons why people need later abortion access care, which I think is important to mention, the first is that you find out information later in your pregnancy that you could not have known earlier. So those are a lot of the medical fetal anomalies that you hear about. You know, you don't do an anatomy scan until 20 weeks in a pregnancy. That's halfway through your pregnancy. You could find out something even further on from that that requires you to have some, you know, very timely access to abortion care. The second is later discovery of pregnancy. This happens commonly with young people, people who inconsistently use birth control, people who have chronic pain. So by the time they discover their pregnancy, it could be later. And depending on where they live, there could be barriers to accessing care. They could go to a crisis pregnancy center, which Sharon does in my film. They get told lies and misinformation about their own pregnancy and abortion. And the third, which is an increasingly common reason why people need later abortion in America, is the barriers to access. So like I mentioned, crisis pregnancy centers, the financial impact, having to travel out of state, lies from politicians, confusion about laws, so many different things. So these are the main reasons why people need later abortion care. And the more you realize that this could be literally anyone, it could be anyone that you know, it could be yourself, that you start to realize that there's no sensible and moral or ethical reason to put a limit on abortion because anything could happen. And who wants to get advice from a bunch of strangers in Washington, D.C. about what they should do for their pregnancy later on just because they created a law? Like, it's so ridiculous. People need access to medical care at any point in their lives, but also at any point in their pregnancy. And that's what I want to showcase in this film.
And for those of you who've listened to our podcast a lot, or those of you who don't listen to it very much at all, you'll notice in this conversation that we're using the term later abortion instead of late term abortion. And it may be a subtle difference to you, and you may think they're interchangeable, but they're really not. And I'd love, Asha, for you to talk about why the phrase late term abortion is so stigmatizing.
It's a starting point for pro-choice audiences and for people who watch this film to understand where they can begin with their advocacy. So late-term abortion is an anti-choice propaganda term, which was created by the anti-choice movement in hopes that it would stigmatize the procedure and attach all these emotional tropes and misinformation. So the phrase late-term actually refers to when you are at 40 weeks in a pregnancy. So you've completed your term of pregnancy and now you are considering a C-section or induction to give birth. It actually has nothing, late term has nothing to do with abortion. So that's a really, really important thing to know. The reason why we're using later abortion, because we're typically referring to after the first trimester, so in the second and the third trimester. But if you talk to a medical provider, the good ones, not the anti-choice ones who were at the Supreme Court a few weeks ago, but if you talk to a medical provider, it's just all part of this full spectrum of abortion care. It's just abortion. You know, they don't categorize it. I mean, yes, they have different specialties, whether it's a medication abortion or a procedure that you have to go to a clinic to get as opposed to taking a pill or a series of pills, but it's all part of abortion care. And the more we stigmatize by using inaccurate, medically inaccurate phrases, it just adds to the stigma and it adds to just the shroud of mystery that we feel afraid to touch and talk about and discuss more openly. So starting with language is a really important point.
I also want to say too, something we don't think about a lot is if we are ingrained in using terms like late term abortion, that's the Google search you might use too, if that becomes part of your thing. And so when you type that in, you are going to be flooded with misinformation from the anti-abortion movement who use that term as well. So by us knowing the language, it means that you are also, if you're looking for more information, Googling the proper language is going to give you the proper information.
Yep. That's a really important point.
It's also really important to remind people that while medication, abortion, and abortion pills are an incredible tool for all of us, A, they need to be accessible everywhere, but B, not all abortions can be done with pills. And so to make sure that when we talk about access to abortion care, that we're talking about all ways of care and all people who need it at various different times in their pregnancies.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's this thought that, which Mindy kind of alludes to in the film, and she said more off camera, which we didn't include, but she talks about how she just grew up assuming that it was so easy to get an abortion. And at any point, if you needed it, you could just go to grab one on the corner while you're on your grocery run. Like, they're so easy to access. They are not. And the further you go along in your pregnancy, it becomes harder and harder and harder. And so that could potentially get worse if this upcoming Supreme Court decision, Idaho v. United States, depending on how that goes, that could completely decimate access to emergency abortion care later in a pregnancy. You know, they say things like, you know, the anti-abortion movement, they say things like, oh, we'll make exceptions for, you know, tragic reasons. And it's like, wait, so I have to be violated or something has to go horribly wrong for me to have an exception. But they make those laws intentionally vague so that they can find loopholes and they can deny you, like what happened to Kate Cox in Texas. Yeah. And so that is what's on the line in this Supreme Court case that's going to be heard in April. The ruling won't come out till the end of summer, but potentially a state could then go, oh, you need an emergency abortion procedure later in your pregnancy. Sorry, we don't want to provide that. And now we don't have to, thanks to the Supreme Court. So this is what's on the line this year.
There's a lot on the line this year. I also just want to touch just very, very briefly, you know, people don't understand how hard it is to access abortion in many parts of this country, and we don't talk about it. And so you just don't know until you are in an emergency need for abortion care, just, you know, because you don't want to be pregnant. And people are like, wait, what do you mean their clinics are miles and miles away? What do you mean there's no clinic in my state? What do you mean that it's not an allowed procedure? And that's for all abortion care, not just later care.
And Dr. Mira Shah, who's a family physician for Planned Parenthood in New York, she's practiced in Texas and Indiana. And she talks about the drastic difference in healthcare access, depending on your zip code, depending on your financial status. In this country, for people who are familiar with systemic racism that's embedded into the healthcare system, depending on your background, you could be discriminated against and put you further out of reach to abortion care. So all these factors play a huge role in what kind of care you get. And so I think it's really important for people to know that abortion is not easy to access, even if you're in a state. I live in California and people assume it's easy, but you go outside of, you know, Los Angeles County, you're in like a lot of deep red, deep conservative cities and towns where people protest outside abortion clinics. And up until a certain point, you may not be able to access abortion care. You probably still have to go to Colorado. And so
I was in New York City in the middle of Manhattan and ended up at a fake clinic when I needed an abortion once. So everywhere in the middle of Manhattan. Yeah. So it's really everywhere. And if you don't know, you don't know.
Yeah.
I also wanted to just go back to the stigma, because all these barriers are created, and it's a lot of the reason that people do have to have later abortion care, right? They can't find the money. They can't get to the clinic. They don't know. And it seems like rather than talking about the way that politicians create these barriers, we really spend time stigmatizing the people who need the abortion care. Why do you think that we don't have much compassion for people who struggle to have care, and we're just really quick to demonize them?
Moji, I don't think we have enough time to answer.
Fair.
That's fair. We have a whole podcast about that. You're right.
I'm glad. Reference this episode. But I think it goes back to the idea that predominantly female-identifying individuals are seen as unreliable narrators in our lives. And so we need an outside force, whether it's a politician, a religious leader, some patriarchal figure, to come and tell us what is best for us. And so that's like the root of a lot of these laws that seek to take away our bodily autonomy, that primarily impacts women of color in this country, LGBTQIA plus folks, and female identifying individuals. Anyone that has the capacity to get pregnant, there's this immediate idea that, oh, you are not in control. You shouldn't be in control. And so here are some laws to tell you what to do. And so it's so easy to buy into this stigma. I come from a religious background where women were buying into these patriarchal ideas, like they were upholding the patriarchy. And so that's how it gets perpetuated, that, you know, many people are continuing to say these things without realizing that it's, you know, like voting against your own best interest. And so this is why I want to really hone in on pro-choice audiences, because I want people to know that, hang on a second, what you're saying is stigmatizing. What you're saying is not true. Dig into that a little bit more. Challenge your own internal stigma toward later abortion. Do some research, watch this film, you know, ask questions and talk to people. I guarantee every person knows someone who has had an abortion later in pregnancy in their life. As I've been making this film, when I tell people what I've been working on, 9 times out of 10, I hear someone say to me, let me tell you about my story. Oh, this happened to me. And a lot of people don't even know that this is a later abortion, because there's stigma on language, there's stigma on sharing abortion stories publicly. And so once we kind of chip away at that a little bit, which I think abortion storytelling in this country is doing in a just profound way, then we can kind of chip away at that stigma and really turn it on its head and be like, you're anti-abortion? Oh my God, like, who are you? You know, like that should be the embarrassing position, not the default.
I agree. And I think it's so important too, when we talk about, one of the reasons that I love this film is because it pushes up against the respectability narrative of pro-choice people when they hear Nikki Haley say, well, you know, I think a 12-week ban could work. And you hear other people who I can't say who are running for office and others who aren't. A 15-week ban, that's it. They pull these numbers out of the sky and they try to make it sound like there's some respectable time that it's a line you cross that they will be. And I always like to say, at what point in your pregnancy would you think it's fine for the government to take away all of your decisions and start making them for you? Because if the answer is never, that should be never for everyone.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that I think is so important about this film, and why I opened by saying right now at this time, this film is everything. So where can people see this film? And what steps are you telling people to take with this film after they watch it?
Yeah, so right now it's playing at the online Women's Voices Now Festival, which you can buy a ticket to online. Just go to womensvoicesnow.com. And that's it's a month-long festival up until April 30th. I've got a screening in LA on May 8th. And beyond that, I've submitted it to, feels like, 1,000 film festivals. And so you can go to someoneyouknowdoc.com, and I've got a list of upcoming screenings. Mental note to self, update that page. But stay up to date. There's a bunch of resources on there. There's all stuff about the film, and there's screening information there. But if you would like to get in touch with me, and if you are an organization, I didn't make this film to make money or to, you know, recoup any of my expenses. I want this to get out there as much as possible, especially before the election. So if you're an organization, a community center, or anyone who wants to show this film to your community, group, family, whoever, please get in touch. Just go to someoneyouknowdoc.com, and there's a contact page, and please reach out to me. I've had so many wonderful emails and inquiries, and I love them all. So please keep them coming.
Asha, thank you so much. I love that also you really are most committed to getting this information out there. And we will make sure all of this is in our show notes, and that everyone who's listening to our podcast knows exactly how to get in touch with you.
Thank you, Moji. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you, Asha.
Make sure you go to someoneyouknowdoc.com to see more resources about later abortion, and get in touch if you'd like to arrange a screening of the film.
And now, It's the party game that's faster than Monopoly and more fun than Taboo, 6 degrees of Abortion. This is where Moji takes a story from the news, and I have 6 chances to link it to abortion. Let's see if she can stump me this week, because I miserably failed last week.
It's hilarious that you remember that. This one is so inserious. I'm actually really excited about it. So this week, we're going to just get a little like celestial, a little galactic. I would like you to link this coming eclipse to abortion.
This coming eclipse to abortion?
Yeah.
Well, I will say that Kristen, who is our programs director, and Marcy, who is a super volunteer with us over in Ohio, I know are going to watch it. It's somebody's like cool ass, like lake place, I think, in Indiana, if I'm not mistaken. Is that linking it to abortion?
That is, I think mine is better. I only gave it to you because I had solved it beforehand. In 2017, there was also a solar eclipse that was visible from the United States. And a certain person who is running for president right now called Donald Trump looked directly at the sun.
Oh, well, I mean, I could do that too, but I was talking about this one because I watched it in Niagara Falls. I had glasses. Yeah, yeah. I was driving across country with my dogs to come to Minnesota, and I watched that eclipse with Brad. Remember Brad, my dog walker?
Were you the only person not in the office then? Because I was on our rooftop with Kat and a bunch of a lot of AAF staff watching it from our like Gowanus rooftop. You weren't there for that?
I was not there for that. I had to go to a wedding, and then I was driving across country, and then we were going to start the Vagical Mystery Tour shortly after that, mm-hmm. or something. I don't know why I was driving across country, but I was.
Liz, you made it.
I made it. I feel like I'm good. It wasn't my best, but it worked.
I mean, it's literally the moon and the sun, Liz. It's a little too celestial to be that specific.
I know. I know. I kind of want to see it, but I think no go here in Minnesota.
No, not at all. We have I think we're having like 90% or 80 something percent coverage in New York. I'm going to try.
Excellent.
Our next guest is a comedian, lawyer, social scientist, and an incredible uncouth politics sleuth. Please welcome Elizabeth Booker Houston. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Elizabeth.
Hey, y'all.
So good to see you again. So I found you organically on TikTok, just like being funny, and loved it because your work is political, hilarious, snarky, basically our kind of vibe. So like, when did you figure out you had permission to be funny? Because that's so rarely offered as an option for women and femme people.
I don't know. Probably actually when I was really young, because I have the best dad in the whole world. My dad, Troy, is very much a girl dad. Got 4 daughters, 1 son, lots of granddaughters. And he very much encouraged me to be the boss of everything and rule the world and do all the things and not just like go and get married and pop out babies and be a homemaker, which is totally fine if that's what you want to do. But he was like, you don't have to do that just because that's what society tells you want to do. And so he introduced me to stand up. And I used to play the Kings of Comedy VHS tape constantly when I was in elementary school, and I learned like every line. And yeah, that kind of started everything. So I've always been a little bit of a class clown, always brought something funny, you know, to wherever I was. I remember they made me class speaker in law school, and they were just laughing through the whole speech because I was extremely unserious the entire time.
I'm from 4 girls and a boy in my family too. And my dad was kind of the same way, except he was super conservative, but he was like, you know, do whatever you want. And then I remember he said to us, I really screwed up because I raised you kids to have an opinion and I forgot to tell you it was supposed to be mine. And so it was just like this defiance of like, I don't know, you're surrounded by a bunch of strong women and these dads are like, okay, go for it. You're my team.
When I graduated law school, I had my wedding the Sunday before I graduated law school. So I had my wedding Sunday and then my law school graduation that Saturday. And after graduation, my dad was like, pulled me in the room and he said, I didn't get you a wedding gift. He was like, because this is more important. You're becoming a lawyer. It's more important. He's like, not that I don't love Billy, my husband. Not that I'm not excited for you, not happy for your marriage, but you have a great marriage. But this is really, really important. And then he gave me like a law school graduation gift. So all about raising a strong, independent woman. They're not going to hold me back.
So the lawyer, social scientist, comedian pipeline, this is the road less explored. How are you working that?
Well, I'm lucky, a lot of privilege, just point blank period. Like people ask that, especially when you bring in the whole, like I'm a mom too. And so people are like, oh, I didn't do that privilege. I get to work from home 100%. And I have a job with great benefits and security here in DC. And, you know, my husband also works from home 100%. And I mean, yeah, that is the main thing, because I have people say that all the time, like, oh my gosh, how can that? I feel so lame because you accomplished so much in a day. And I'm like, well, yeah, but there's like a ton of privilege with it. And I can fully see that as someone who grew up with the exact opposite of privilege, because I grew up dirt fucking poor in Memphis. So like seeing like the opposite side of things. And yeah, and I'm a nerd. I'm a dork. I like to read and learn stuff. And so that's fun. But the whole comedian thing, I didn't really have an expectation for that to happen later in life. But then my brother died, my nephew died, and then a global pandemic hit. And then after that, I was like, man, fuck it. I want to be a comedian. So that's what I'm going to do. I don't care that it's like a pipe dream. We're going to do it.
Sometimes it takes those things to really wake you up into a space. And you and I are a lot in common in the sense that we get on the internet and we spew our thoughts and hot takes and opinions. And boy, the fucking men come out and they are mad about it. So hardly mad. So I want to know from you, because I know what triggers them when I start saying shit. Is there a topic when you just start going hard that they just go completely ham?
The thing that makes them really mad is when the first guy comes in and says something like, oh, you're an ugly, miserable person. I'm like, no, I was a model from the time I was 17 to 24. I'm actually really fucking pretty. So no. And then that seems to be the thing that sets them off the most. It's the most superficial thing, but I'm not even really that cocky. I just say that because I know it pisses them off. So like, I will just let them know, like, yeah, you can't call me stupid. You can't say I'm broke because you know I'm a lawyer in DC. You can't say no one will love me because they find out I have a husband and that pisses them off because they want to call me a spinster. So the next thing they go with is, oh, you're ugly. And I'm like, no, I'm not.
You're adding pretty privilege onto the list.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah. I just toss it in there. I'm just like, no, you just, I'll say things like, quit trying to neg me, man. I already got a husband. I don't, go away.
I mean, it's a lot. And I have to say too, like, one of the things I do love about you the most is you seem to be, if there was something called Charlie Kirk Watch, we could rename your Insta to Charlie Kirk Watch, because you always bring me, every time Charlie Kirk steps in it, I'm like, okay, what's Elizabeth saying? Charlie Kirk. And he sent him to shit this week.
Yeah.
Talk to me about it.
He had this whole spiel. I don't even know where the hell it was. But Under the Desk News is actually where I saw the clip first, which I love Under the Desk News, by the way.
Oh, we do too.
B is incredible.
Shout out to
B. Is super cool. Shout out to V. And I saw the clip and I was like, oh, this jackass. And so he's going on and on about birth control and how women shouldn't be taking it, and that it's prescribed to so many women under the age of 25 for stuff like acne and to control your period. And he says that really flippantly, as if like, that's not a huge deal. Fuck off, dude. And then he just says, yeah, women shouldn't be on it because it has all of these side effects and it makes women bitter. He said one of the side effects is it makes you bitter. No, it's not the patriarchy. It's not the terrible systems in place that are like holding us down. It's the birth control.
It's not you, Charlie Kirk.
It's actually Charlie Kirk. Control. We are bitter because of Charlie Kirk. Also, he's bitter because he's an unfuckable guitar pick looking motherfucker that nobody wants to have that guy soil them. Like, I don't want him. Can you imagine being dick deep in Charlie Kirk? Like, no, thank you. No, like no one imagines that. And Charlie Kirk knows that the reaction to him is that of like literally feta cheese. And he has to live with that. And like, that's not my problem.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. And he's just miserable. And also, I've just been coming at him hard lately because I had a video I made that went crazy viral about Kyle Rittenhouse.
Please tell this story.
Please tell us about it. Yes.
So I saw that Kyle Rittenhouse was invited to speak at the University of Memphis. That's my alma mater. Okay. So I went to get my graduate degree and my law degree. And I'm from Memphis. I lived in Memphis for 27 years, like my whole life, did all my education there before I came up to DC. Anybody from Memphis, you understand that we say we're not from Tennessee, we're from Memphis. And it's very much like I'm tied to my community. And so when I saw this, I was like, this is some fuck shit. How is Kyle Rittenhouse coming to speak at the University of Memphis in a city that is majority Black? It's like 69% Black folks.
Also, what does that boy have to say?
Not shit. And so I made a video. I was like, okay, bet. So I made a video saying, why is the University of Memphis sending this guy? We all need to be pissed, blah, 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 blah. Tag some different pages that could share it and push it out and whatever. And it kind of took off. And before I knew it, everybody who had seen the video were like in the University of Memphis, like they were up their ass. Like, why are you bringing this dude here? Turned out it was Charlie Kirk and his fucking Turning Point USA. And he had established a chapter at the Memphis campus of students. And so he was the reason Kyle Rittenhouse was coming to speak. And Kyle came. And because of all the hubbub we made, and we got like the Unapologetically Memphis page, like all the local pages talk about it too, a ton of students showed up and showed out. And they chased his ass off campus. Literally chased that little motherfucker off the campus. Is the funniest shit I ever saw. Because Memphis is rough. That is a rough city. I'm just like, wait a minute. This is where you decided to come? Like, come on, sir. But no, he talked for 27 minutes and then got booed off of that stage so quick. Got taken. This young man named Moses, who was the president of the University of Memphis debate club, like asked him very intellectual, very specific questions. And Kyle couldn't answer his fucking questions and couldn't argue with the evidence he brought. So he just walked off stage and then everybody just chased him off to his car. So that was great. The president of the student chapter resigned that day, apparently, because of all the backlash, as she should, because why are you being a little shithead?
Why are you being Charlie Kirk's like lotionette
errand person?
And the university, like they said, we have to let them speak because First Amendment. I was like, okay, I get that. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't the university inviting them. Like the university had no hand in it. So I was like, okay.
That's that slippery slope. I'm kind of with you. It's like if there's a weird club on campus that invites a creep, and they have the First Amendment right to be a creep, then I don't know. I feel like everyone else has the First Amendment right to like snatch up all the tickets and then it's an empty room.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also show up and run the creep off their campus.
Yeah. I reserved a ticket. I wasn't going, but I reserved my empty seat and, you know, encouraged others to do the same. But yeah, the students who showed up, I was real proud. I was like, yeah. And I took the clips of him getting chased off campus and set it to the song, Yeah, Glow by Glorilla. And it was good.
How many people, for those that didn't see the clip, we'll put it in our show notes, but how many people would you say, and you know this university, so how big was the room he was booked in, and how many bodies could you sort of approximate actually ended up in that place?
I didn't see any supporters beyond the students who were part of the organization. I think it looks like it was pretty much all protesters. The room is really big. It was pretty empty from what I could tell from the clips. Probably had like, it looked like maybe 50 students or something in the room, but the number of students on the campus, like Chase, also the band kids showed up and played music to play him off.
Oh, wow.
A lot of people showed up.
Did they play the Seinfeld theme? Cause that would have been awesome.
That would have been good. I don't think they did, but that would have been great. Really proud of my hometown. Like Memphis is, we got some work to do, but you know, every now and then my hometown does something that makes me real proud. That was a proud moment.
You know, you are super good at identifying things and telling folks, you know, where it's at. What would you say is like your proudest moment of raising awareness and seeing action or result being taken because of it?
Oh man. Oh, that's such a hard question. As of right now, what's made me really happy is I got an email today from a political organization to potentially collaborate. And they mentioned that video that I'd made about disinformation had made it to a member of Congress and had influenced them. So I was like, I don't know who it was specifically. I don't know all the details, but I was like, all right, that's pretty fucking cool. So it's nice that to see that. And yeah, I know that there are elected representatives watching. Like I know I had the governor of Pennsylvania, you know, Shapiro had reached out and had me interview him on my platform and stuff. And I've had other public officials reach out. I'm like, man, I cuss and I'm snarky and I'm mean as shit. And you want to be on my platform? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, all right, that's cool. All right. I'm tired of respectability politics. Let's do it.
Oh, so are we.
So on top of your online activism, you were out in DC with us in the streets last week. So can you talk about why you were hanging out with AAF and how you became a fearless abortion activist?
Yeah. So I was hanging out with AAF because you guys were kind enough to invite me after I'd signed up to volunteer at the No One Asked You premiere in DC, the documentary, you know, that followed the Vagical Mystery Tour. So that was such a good documentary. And I signed up to volunteer. And we knew that they were hearing on March 26th. It was the oral arguments for the Mifepristone case that came out of the shitty Fifth Circuit, which I teach food and drug law as an adjunct professor. And I told my law students, I was like, that circuit is the bane of my existence. I swear to God. but that case came from the Fifth Circuit to basically say that the FDA didn't have the ability to change the REMS, which is the risk mitigation standard for mifepristone, the abortion pill, right? So they had the oral arguments. You guys let me come out and protest in front of the Supreme Court while they had the oral arguments going on and hold up that lovely sign with Clarence Thomas's face on it, which I requested.
My favorite thing about that sign is that it calls his wife the ginsurrectionist.
So good. No, the number of people when I posted on Instagram who were like, oh my God, the part that said he's coming for our birth control, but where will he store it? That was that was good.
Oh my God.
And those pictures are everywhere.
Yes.
They're huge signs. They're everywhere.
You are so good too. You were like out there, like fearless. It was kind of incredible to watch.
Yeah. When you were trying to take down that, there was this white guy who had a whole personality kerfuffle going on his sign. And do you remember his sign?
Yeah.
And you were trying to block his sign, but like talk about his sign and then talk about your literally Benny Hill kind of like movements around trying to block that guy. Because that guy was gross.
That guy was gross. I was so confused. He was a conservative Jew who was pro-Palestine and anti-abortion, and I could not figure him out.
I don't think he could figure himself out.
He had a sign that said something like no dead babies in Gaza or in the womb either, or something like that. It was something like that. Like he was trying to be pro-Palestine and anti-abortion at the same time, which is like my guy. So he was getting in front of Aid Access, who, you know, were there with their little robots that were spitting out mifepristone, and they were trying to do their demonstration. And he was like getting in front of them and their sign and everything. And Liz was like, you should go play a game of chase and block him with your giant Clarence Thomas sign. And I did. I have a 6'2" wingspan. Okay. And I used it.
That's what I was about to say. Please tell them that I asked you because you are literally an American Eagle.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Or literally. A condor.
I am 5'10 with a 6'2" wingspan, which is ridiculous. I'm so disproportionate, but it helps in moments like this. So I was able to just keep jumping and leaping in front of this guy. And then he finally gave up after I just kept blocking him and he walked off and gave up. And so that was a great moment. But you guys didn't see this moment that happened when we were blocking the pro-lifers. You guys had gone to go record the podcast, so you weren't here for this. We were blocking the pro-lifers with a giant sign. And this girl who was part of, what is that one organization, the Progressives?
Oh, that's what that guy was from too.
Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising, POW, they say.
So one of the girls from that group wearing an LGBT flag on her back walked up and said, can I get through? And the pro-life guy like elbowed her and like blocked her and kind of like bumped into her hard. She was like, can I please get through? And she said, I'm one of you guys. I was like, oh, baby.
I know.
Also, Progressive Anti-Abortion Organization had like 4 people with them. How come they didn't know each other? That's just wild.
That was weird. And then there was the girl who was pregnant with her belly all out and had like, and I'm just like, I don't know. I don't want to judge, but I was judging. I was like, yeah. What is happening there, girl? Not with the belly being out. I'm not judging about that. I wear a crop top all day, every day, even when I'm pregnant. But I was confused. It's like, why are you painting this stuff on the belly and out here with these people? Come on. Come on.
Yeah. Especially when like she's far enough along in her pregnancy that mifepristone wouldn't be something you would take if you wanted to terminate your pregnancy. You would go in for an in-clinic abortion. So I'm like, What's your point even? You don't even understand why you're here, what you're here, and what you're doing. So you are a delight to talk to. We have to go. But before we go, you got to tell everybody about your new podcast.
Oh, you saw that?
Yes. Are you kidding? We stalk you on the Instagrams.
You announced it on your Insta.
Well, okay. Well, you guys will have to then repay the favor and come be on my podcast.
Of course.
Absolutely.
It's called The Devil's Opposing Counsel because I'm sick and tired of devil's advocates. So that is the name. I give in 30-minute chunks, try to break down like law and politics. I talk real fast and break stuff down like these 90-second videos on Instagram. And everybody's like, can you stretch it out, talk a little slower and break things down? Sure. So I got this podcast, just launched it on Spotify, on YouTube. It is also on my website. You can just listen there at thedevilsopposingcounsel.com. So I'm super excited. The first episode is all about the mifepristone case. I talked about No One Asked You, and I talked about Abortion Access Front in that episode. So,
woohoo! Yeah. I am so glad we met. It's just like so fortuitous that Moji saw you on social. I saw you on social. And then our development director, Stephanie's like, she's my friend. And I was like, that is so random. What are you even talking about? How does this even work? But of course, you know, we're all 6 degrees of abortion.
Yeah.
Please come back anytime. And please, 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 please be part of our shenanigans again, because you're really good at shenans.
Please, you don't say less. I will be there. I know I won't be able to be part of the next things, which I will not spoil in case you've not shared, upcoming, because I have to go to Berlin. But hopefully you will be able to take over my socials that day.
I also want to talk you into coming to Chicago with us to the DNC to talk some Democrats into being better at talking about abortion.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. You're the best.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks, guys.
Follow Elizabeth's awesome content at Booker Squared on Insta and TikTok, and check out her podcast, The Devil's Opposing Counsel, wherever you pod.
That's our show.
It is our show. We did a good show.
We had a great show. It was a two Liz show.
It was a double. What does that mean, a two Liz show?
It was a double. It was Elizabeth double.
It was. Oh my God. It was Elizabeth Squared.
Elizabeth Squared.
Instead of Booker Squared. I feel kind of excited about that.
Thanks for listening. And thanks again to Asha Daya. And be sure to go to someoneyouknowdoc.com for more info on later abortion and her wonderful short film.
Okay. Did we make you smarter? Did we make you laugh today? If we did, show us some love by liking, subscribing, and giving us 5 stars. Plus, stay connected with us on social media at Abortion Front across all the platforms. With your help, we can get more people to learn about the assault on abortion access. And if you haven't already, go sign our petition at aafront.org and ask the FDA to use their power to protect mifepristone.
Looking for where you might fit in to do some abortion activism? We've got a 5-part activist training series, Operation Save Abortion, at operationsaveabortion.com. And visit our super cool activist calendar, which is full of local and national actions and educational opportunities. New York Friends on April 8th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, Ancient Song, BK Forge, and Reproductive Freedom for All NY are excited to host the New York Equal Rights Amendment Teach-In. This in-person event will teach folks how New York's Equal Rights Amendment, ERA, protects all of us, including pregnant New Yorkers, women, LGBTQ+ people, those with disabilities, older adults, and people from different cultures and countries. Link in show notes.
And every other person living or dead.
All of them. Every
you listed
one.
All the people.
There's no other people left.
That's right. And next week's guest, professor from American University and one of the most badass researchers in the whole reproductive movement, Tracy Wheats, will join us. Plus, my friend, comedian and writer, Lori Kilmartin. He's here to talk about her new special, Cis Woke Grief Slut.
That's a fun title.
Mm-hmm.
Join our Patreon. You'll support great content and get cool FBK merch and experiences. All pledges support this pod and all of our activism at Abortion Access Front. Pledge at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills. FBK is edited by Remy de Tournay and is produced by Abortion Access Front.
And finally, we leave you with Pastor Joel Webbin, a man showing his whole ass as he admits he's scared of women voting.
Because if we had a Christian nation tomorrow and women did have the right to vote, we would not have a Christian nation within 50 years.
Okay, elaborate a little bit on that.
Because the husband has been appointed by God as the head of his home.
Mm.
And no-fault divorce and women's suffrage, more than anything else, ultimately split the household.
Mm.
So we're not talking about women not having a say in society. We're talking about representative government.
That's right.
Feminist Buzzkills, the podcast from Abortion Access Front. New episodes drop Friday. When BS is popping, we pop off. And if you want to support our podcast and all the work of Abortion Access Front, like, subscribe, and join our Patreon at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills.